Well, this is better attendance than we get Sunday mornings. I hope you've all had a great time. We're going to be set for, I think, a really, really interesting panel and discussion. We're going to involve the audience a lot more with this session than we normally do. I would love to pull an executive decision and ask you all to move forward, but I guess I won't do that. Maybe Bill will do it. Somebody left a pair of glasses in the hospitality room last night. If they're yours or you know, have a roommate who you know lost them, they are up here. I'll try to remember to say that at the end again. We have one of Brian Patrick's DVDs, the Mountain Meadow Massacre thing. If anyone wants it, please let me know. They're $25. I would love to get it sold so I don't have to carry it home and mail it back to him. And we still have the two blankets that are embroidered with Transitions Ex-Mormon Foundation Conference 2007. They're $20 a piece. If anybody wants them, there are two of them available. Well, I'll tell you later. I am in need of someone who lives here who might be able to take some kind of major expenditure wine back to the liquor store for us and get our money back. There are a lot of items in the hospitality room. When we are done today, they are free and available to whoever wants to take them. Our coolers still have quite a bit of beer. And there's snacks and all kinds of stuff that you're welcome to take. But we do have a few bottles of wine that were not opened. And I would really like, I mean, if we can do it. Does anyone know whether you can do that? Because I don't have the sales slips for them. Can you take them back?
If you can do it within a week, then you must have a receipt.
Oh, phooey. Over like $5. For the liquor store?
Just auction the wine off.
Auction it off?
How about we just pass it around? Everybody will like our presentation.
Hey, you know what?
I'll put it back
on the table. Because some of them are these like double bottles. And if you want the ones that are not open, just give us a donation and take what you think's fair. Okay? We'll do it that way. So we'll put those out here afterwards. Oh, we should add some trays. A lot of you did not get your glasses last night because we found them late. The beer glasses that are for, if you didn't get them, they're all out there on the table. Please take the one that was supposed to be at your place. And if you want any more, they are 2 for $5, and they're really a good deal. They're really heavy glasses, last a long time, and they're really fun to have. And again, it's an item that's dated. We really don't want to have to store them for another year, and they'll be out of date next year. So if you're interested, be sure and take the one that you were supposed to get with your registration, and they're out there on the tables out there. Now, very important thing, Bob McHugh is missing the power cord to his laptop. And he believes he left the cord in here. I will check with the hotel. I just found this out. I can't imagine that they would have taken it. But it is an HP. Didn't you say it would have HP marked on it?
HP and the end on it would be actually quite small. It's not one of those big
Okay, so it's a power cord. If anybody sees one wandering around or took it by accident or whatever, I'm sure he would love to have it back. Okay, a couple of just little items of business. Can you go out and ask Diane to come in for just... Oh, there you are. There you are. Well, too quick. I've only known Diane a few months, but when we had a resignation on the board a few months ago, this person was going to be my registration chairman, and I went into utter panic because it is a huge job. And it's really the key to so much of what goes on here. And as you, a lot of you who came late or bought dinners late and so forth and so on, know that it was she has for not only all the weeks leading up, you know, to the conference, she has sat out there for 2.5 days now and been bombarded by, you know, bazillion requests. And I wanted to thank her for, you know, just being so dependable. She does a lot of other things for the ex-Mormon community. She's the one that runs all the announcements and stuff for the Calm community that has done so many things recently socially. And I would like you to come up here and get a gift from me, please, Diane. This is her little tote bag that she can take to all her Calm activities and carry all her things in. And I made a little special purchase to embellish the bag with this beautiful little silver salamander. And some of you are too young to even know what that's all about. And if you don't know, ask your neighbor. For her to remember us, for us to thank her for all that she's done. Also, Sandy mentioned yesterday when she introduced the DVD, she wasn't really forthcoming with you about how crazy it was the last few weeks trying to get this done in time. We had some real major editing things to do at the end because our vision and that of the videographer didn't match sometimes. But we worked it out, and she spent, I mean, there were 2 days in particular. I know she was on the phone with him for 5 and 6 hours. That, you know, not just hang up and call back. We're talking, he's screaming at him, yeah. And between the two of us, we would bounce these things back and forth, take this out, put this in, you know. And also, she and Kathleen, are you in here? I think Kathleen's comatose this morning. Did a lot of research on the quotes that were used, which I think were just vital to the DVD. I mean, for people who come in and see it, those are things that a lot of Mormons, you know, those quotes are not aware of. So I arranged for a special version of our blankets to give to Sandy as a remembrance.
Well, and kind of the same thing for Sue. I mean, she puts in countless hours every year for this. It's a thankless job. I personally think we should all take up a fund and send her on a cruise every year after this, because she's just exhausted. But Sue has a thing for salamanders, so for some strange reason. So we found her this necklace that was made by I think it was Ellen Miller, and she makes beautiful jewelry, and it has some gemstones in it. And it has a salamander in the middle, and this is what we want to give this to.
That's what she was doing yesterday.
Well, I as I've said at the beginning of each session, the people who are presenting, their bios are on the sheet. But these three people are particularly dear to me. Janet. Has been a friend since about the time she finally booted herself out, and she found me. She lives in she did live in Oregon, a couple hundred miles from where I lived, and she got a hold of Richard Packham and talked to him for a while, and then he said, "I think you need to talk to Sue, because it was obvious she needed to talk to another woman." And I think it took her about 20 phone calls. I had these phone calls, these mysterious phone calls that would hang up when I'd answer or before I could answer. She was so afraid because she didn't know me, you know. But anyway, long story short, she ended up coming to my home and spending the weekend, and it's just been a great friendship ever since. And Bill and Mel have been part of this community for a long, long time, and Bill has presented before, and the things he has to say are great, and he and Mel have just a relationship that I so admire and envy. They've been through an awful lot together. This last year I know has been particularly difficult for them for some family reasons, and they deal with, you know, blended families and all that, and I know that they have just some really good things for us today, and the way we have structured this, and I've instructed them, and the reason I blocked this for this time was so it would be a little more casual and that we could have plenty of interaction with the audience. So I'm going to turn the time over to them.
S-
Speaking of the salamander stuff, where the hell is Steve Clark? Did he finally get over this?
No, he just doesn't come much anymore.
Okay.
I
was pretty sure Steve would never get over it, so that makes me feel better. Our intention is to be kind of as short as we can up here and then involve all of you. So really, if you want to come up, as we get more intimate here, that'll probably work better. But if you don't, that's cool too. But what we want to do, we're each going to say our little diddly things for a few minutes. And then rather than talk too much about it, I'd like to show you a journey beyond Mormonism. And I'll do a little disclaimer before we do that. But I think we're actually going to start with Janet. And I got to tell you, Janet was such an amazing person to me. It took me 7 years from the beginning of my questioning to where I finally stopped believing. I think Janet did it in like 2 months or something like that. Wasn't that it? So we all have our own different paths and journeys, but we're going to start with Janet and then Mel. And then I've got kind of a stuffy thing I'm going to do before we get to the fun stuff. So...
Thank you. I am uncomfortable just sitting here, but it's just the way it is, and hope that I can say something that might help you all on your journey. First of all, I have to say thank you to everybody that's here. I could never have gotten to where I am today without everyone. It was so frightening, and I know they've sort of titled this our journey from fear to passion, and my fear was tremendous, and I was scared to death to feel all alone. I felt like I was on a ship up in the Bering Straits out fishing or something, and I decided to just jump overboard without a life jacket. And as a convert, I thought, well, my family probably always thought I was a little bit crazy, especially when I joined the Mormon Church. So now that I was going to tell them that I was out of the church, you know, would they accept me? And then I lost a lot of my Mormon friends too. But it's all worked out, and I'm just so glad to be here. My thoughts are really all about the fact that it's about my journey and how I've experienced it, and it's about you. And that's why I'm looking forward to hearing some of your questions and thoughts of how you've gotten to be here. A little bit about me is that I was born in Florida, good military family, and traveled to Newfoundland, and then we ended up on Mercer Island, Washington, just outside of Seattle. My dad was in the Navy, aviator, and he retired when I was young. I had a wonderful home, a lot of love and support and great summer days. We lived on the water and just putting my swimsuit on in the morning and swimming all day and being with two brothers that we would laugh all the time and it was good. I felt comfortable. We went to church a little bit, but it wasn't a huge thing. I was 9 years old when we decided to go on a trip to California. And my mother wasn't feeling very well. And that's where, unfortunately, they found out that she had stomach cancer. And she passed away. And so that was a shock and kind of woke me up a little bit. I came back. And so I was in the fourth grade. And one of my first memories of that was recess. And I thought, hey, everybody should be playing with me. You know, my mom just died. And I felt really alone. And I stood there for a while, and I thought, well, this isn't working. I guess I'll need to have to go with them because everybody has, you know, their own paths and their own joys. And so I thought I need to be with everybody else and put myself out there. So I hope that by doing this, I can share my life with you and some of the paths that I've gone through. What happened then is when I met the missionaries when I was a junior in high school, they posed the question about who am I and where have I come from, where am I going? And then, they said, well, would you like to know how you could be with your mother forever? And I said, well, yes. So I listened to the lessons, and I did. I joined the church, went off to BYU, and got married and had 5 children in 7 years. And I'm glad I had my children. They're just the light of my life. And my oldest son is here, and I'm so glad that he is. I just think, wow, that's... Changed my life. So my path of having my children and being active in the church, I'm grateful for a lot of it. Probably the first time that I really sort of questioned the church was when I went to the temple. And some of you may have had this experience also. Looking around, you have all these wonderful people, and they believe in it, so it must be true. And the lady I was sitting next to, I remember she handed me a lifesaver. Those lifesavers. I thought, oh, is this part of the ceremony? I look around. and, oh, well. But then when they did the motion of the promise that you'll never divulge the secrets in there, otherwise it'd be better that my life be taken, and I motioned that I would do that to my throat, I thought, whoa, is everybody else doing this? Did I really do just what I thought I did? And that was, I thought, gosh, there's something maybe not quite right about this. So that might have been one of my first, but really it only took me a few weeks. It was when I was older, my oldest son had just gotten married in the temple, my daughter was getting ready to go, and that's when I thought, wait a minute, do I really want to be a mother that to guide her into this, to say this is the only way of some joy and happiness? And so when I started to question it, it's funny, I don't know if you've had this experience, when those thoughts first come to your mind, you really, it's hard to go back. Then I put it into the computer, and boy, that was scary for me. As how silly that was! I thought, well, I didn't want to put leaving the Mormon Church in there because somebody might check my history and then they'd really know. So, but then when I put in there leaving the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I came up with Richard Packham's website, and I called him. And even then, I didn't want to just waste his time. And he said, wait just a moment. Are you calling me about the Mormon Church? I said, yes. And what a great man he is, that Richard Packham. Yes. Yeah. He helped me stay on the line, a line that gave me a connection to somebody else who was questioning. And then he said, you know, I think you would enjoy talking to someone else I know that you'd be safe with. Her name is Sue Emmett. And he gave me Sue's phone number, but dang it, she wouldn't let blocked numbers in. And we had our number blocked for reasons. And so it did. It took me about 5 calls to finally, okay, just unblock your number. Who cares who you are? So that so I called her and had that connection. And that, from that moment on, somehow I tripped across that saying that says, be who you are, say what you feel, because those that matter don't mind, and those that mind don't matter. Something to that effect. Somebody else may be able to say who actually said that. And I realized that's when I needed to just be who I was. So I started my reading, my path. I was blessed enough to run into to Bill and Mel, and they are so real. And they picked me up and carried me for a little while. When I first met them, I came down, actually had set up a counseling appointment for one of my children who couldn't make it. And I thought, oh, what? I've never been to counseling, and just met with Bill, and then we ended up, we met as friends. And I'm just so thankful for all of them. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. My journey out. One of my other favorite statements is Eleanor Roosevelt's. I've always had this up in my kitchen about great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people. It was this saying that I remember during maybe some Relief Society lessons or being with church members. I thought, wow, seems like everybody only talks about people. And I wanted to talk about ideas. I wanted to value people's different feelings and their thoughts and their passions. I saw my children being kind of stopped about if they had a different idea, and I wanted to encourage them to have their own feelings. So those are some of the great things I've experienced since I've been out. When I left, and then I went through a divorce and I'm single, I thought, wow, what do I do now that I'm not a Mormon? I'm free to think. I thought, well, I'm going to join organizations that I want to do. So, like, I love to camp and hike, so I joined the REI. I wanted to join. I love music, go to concerts. I like to go to movies. I can go to movies, the ones that I want to go to. Read the books that I want to read. I love to sit with people and just listen to their thoughts. I don't have to process it all. I don't have to judge them anymore. It's like, wow, that's a freeing thought. I sell real estate up in Seattle, and I'm in an area of Redmond, Washington, and they have a software company, I guess, some computer companies that hire people from all around the world. And that's been a real eye-opener for me, too, to listen to them, try to respect their own views and ideas. It's just been a wonderful experience. I love to have a glass of wine now with friends and over dinner and have some good conversations about ideas. So that's where I'm at. I hope that my example to my children, when I first told my children I did not want to tell them to leave the church, when I told them I was leaving, I just said, I will always love you for who you are and what you want to do with your life. This is my decision. And then my decision to have my name taken off the records of the church was huge, too. But I didn't want my children to feel like I was telling them what to do. But four of my five children have left. I'm really happy for them and look forward to watching and observing how they live their life. So the whole idea of leaving the fear behind has taken more time, I think, than I really thought. I think when I first even met with Bill and Mel, I was only out for a couple months. And I thought, oh, I'll be over this. And the first conference I came to, this is my fourth conference, I thought, oh, I won't need to come back again. But as someone said this morning at breakfast, I've never met another ex-Mormon. There's an energy that comes from meeting other people. And so I'm glad that I'm here for my fourth conference, and if I can help anybody, I'm up in Seattle, give me a phone call. We have parties, and we're going to have more, and just gatherings that get together to let everybody know, because the energy that we feel, we need to keep listening to that inner voice or spirit, whatever it is to you, what it is to me, and share that with each other. So I'll pass the time over to Bill and Mel, and thanks for being here.
While we're each doing our little thing, I hope everybody, you know, if you want to get a drink, because I loved that drunk fast and testimony meeting on Friday. Wasn't that fun? I mean, that's the way fast and testimony meetings should be. But we kind of want to recapture some of that energy when we get done here. So as we're talking and you're thinking about things you want to say or questions or comments, that's what this is really all about. So we want to include you all. So.
Okay, I kind of wrote some thoughts down on getting out of our boxes. My journey kind of started when I was a young child, and so here's kind of some of my thoughts on it. I was raised as a very conservative, in a very conservative Mormon family. We were the family in the ward with all the kids. 13 of us ended up coming out of that family. We watched film strips on Worthy Thoughts, Worthy Music, and Johnny Lingo to pass the Sunday afternoons. Scripture readings were daily, and we did not leave the house in the morning without kneeling down for prayer. Family reunions always consisted of a testimony meeting. Conference was always such an event also. We never had a TV in our home, so at conference time, we had a radio in every room. We were expected to take notes and discuss it between the sessions. Excuse me. For me, it seemed much too weird. I started to see how inauthentic, and judgmental it all was when I was in Young Women's. That became real powerful in that time of my life to see the difference in how authentic and people were with other girls and fake, and that was a really hard time for me. And so I eventually became one of those teenagers who decided that the church did not work for me. As a result, I was not fully indoctrinated. I did not go to the temple or serve a mission or anything like that for years. I was kind of out of it. However, I found that I did not need Mormonism to build myself into a safe box to reside in. I camped out along the path in my safe little tent where I would be safe not having to go out or move away from my comfort zone. I had no vision or desire, and I had a lot of fear about moving beyond and growing. I was safe in my little world. I think one of the reasons I left the church was because it was so scary for me. As a young child, I was scared of thunderstorms because I thought it was the second coming, and of course I had not been good. After I was baptized, I remember thinking right after my baptism, I wish I could die, because now I am clean and I will be okay. One sacrament meeting, I think I was about 10 years old, I was sitting there and I thought, what if none of this is true? And this peace came over me, and I think it was at that moment I decided I didn't really want to know. Everyone, no matter our background, Mormon, Catholic, Muslim, or no one with no religion, can choose to grow or not to grow. I was raised to be very submissive, and I was also very insecure. This created a need for some box of safety. But ultimately, inside me, my soul was asleep, and this did not meet my needs for true intimacy, growth, and connection. As we start emerging out of the box, it is very scary, and we need to connect with others traveling down the same path who desire to bask in the warm, mystical waters of the deep. Connecting with like-minded people, like we do here, people who have same struggles and fears, is very comforting. It is very nice to make friends who are real and want to connect with us, not because they have not done it yet for the month. No more duty friends. As we acknowledge the good things the box provided us, we can feel the gratitude for that part of our life, but we must continue to grow. When we were young, Santa was so magical, and we were so grateful for his gifts, but eventually we quit believing and we grew beyond. Recently, I was struggling with some really painful stuff. When I became aware of my feelings, I could feel my heart pounding stronger, my stomach felt clogged up, my legs were tightened, emotion swelled up inside my chest, and then I started to feel alive. I could feel all the life in me with heightened emotion. I became aware that to fully live life, I must be aware in the moment of everything I feel, pain or joy. I would like to suggest that passion be described as feeling, truly feeling, feeling it all. Feel the life around us, the connection, become aware of the miracle of life that is within us. Embrace the pain as well as the joys in life. Pain can be one of the biggest motivators for growth. The pain, fear, and struggles of life can move us to grow and continue on our journey. Openness to life, love, art, creation is heightened in this altered state. Recently, I talked to a young girl who had done some really incredible art, and she healed through her life of abuse. Her comment to me was she had not been able to find quite the creativity she felt when she was healing, and how using her pain to heal had been such an important part in her art. All three of our boys have created their best music as they have been healing through the death of their mother. Their music has not only assisted in their healing, but brought out some incredible creativity and love. As we grow and become more open, loving, and non-judgmental, we begin to open to the life energy of the universe. We become more aware of the connection we have with each other. We become aware that if I hurt you, it hurts me. We crave authenticity and reality and become more passionate and compassionate. The practice of being fully known, authentic, and aware, first with ourselves and then with others. When we are truly connected to others, we feel their pain. At times, it can be so strong that the analogy of Jesus bleeding from every pore when he connected with pain of others can make some sense. A quote by Treya Wilbur best describes the start of moving out of our safe places and becoming our own guide in this magical journey. I need to learn how to read the depths of my being, find my own guidance. To continue on that path, I need to find ways to get in better touch with my deep psyche, the inner principle of ongoing personal growth. This is as close as I can get to the God within me. Learning to understand and follow, that is the same as hearing and obeying God's will. Going within and getting in touch with the deepest, most true part of oneself, getting to know it, nourish it, let it grow more mature, invest it with power, recognizing it as the inner God, and develop the will to follow that inner direction, the ability to test its truth, and the faith and courage to follow it.
I'm going to tell you my story in less than a minute. 1989, I began to question, and there were some. I was teaching seminary at East High, and I taught with a teacher that was a true historian. There's a lot of pseudo scholarship in CES. It was really refreshing to actually get with a guy that was speaking the truth, and that began to open me up. But it took me 7 years. I'm retarded, and So I'm amazed that some people, you know, do it so quickly, but mine was just a really slow journey. Anyway, my divorce was the hardest thing I went through. We tried very hard to put it together, but it wasn't meant to be, and that was the hardest thing I'd ever been through. After that, we built a home together. Mel and I got together, and we built a home, and that was incredibly hard. You know, giving up family and friends, and you know, the whole process of moving beyond, very difficult. But leaving the church wasn't half as hard as the divorce, and I think probably some people that have been through that could agree with me. Leaving the church was a piece of cake compared to the divorce. Having my ex-wife die was twice as hard as all of it. It tweaked my brain chemistry. I'm still not the same. I did an interview with Bill Maher last year, and I've never had performance anxiety until I went down there. I couldn't even think straight. And I think the trauma of going through my ex-wife's death had just tweaked my brain chemistry towards anxiety. And I was surprised and shocked. And so I'm still kind of dealing with all of that. But that's part of life, and I think that's kind of what I want to talk about, is embracing the whole thing. That's my story. Was that less than a minute? Almost. Yeah. I have a paper I wrote. I'm going to read it, and then, like I say, this is the stuffy part, but then we want to have fun and let our hair down and actually show you how, at least show you one version of moving beyond the box. Religion offers potent relief from existential angst and answers to life's great questions. As Mormons, the quality of knowing provided us an especially effective protection from the uncertainties and complexities of postmodern living. As we dismantled the myths of our religion, we came face to face with the realities of not knowing. At this point, we were faced with the complexity of developing our own truths. I call this process becoming your own general authority. This is an essential step in continued growth. Our religion was the sandbox of our early spiritual life and gave us the boundaries that were probably mostly healthy. But man's need for power and control, as experienced through our religion, at some point began to infuse simple truths with contaminants of shame, fear, guilt, and arrogant and elitist ideals. At some point, continued growth required us to take a leap of faith that could take us beyond the confines and safety of our sandbox. The indoctrination, the brainwashing that we experience, limited our ability to trust ourselves and think critically. For truth people, we were eventually compelled to trust ourselves more than the institution that had both defined and protected us, but then limited us and ultimately controlled us. We no longer trusted in that external arm of flesh. However, our identities were infused with the institutional church and its culture. Breaking free from this stranglehold required us to trust ourselves more than the external authority. But we had been programmed that the natural man is evil, carnal, sensual, devilish, an enemy to God. Our ability to trust ourselves had been infused with a potentially toxic system of conformity. Combined with the reality that our ability to think critically was suspended, we were programmed to trust ourselves only if we agreed with the external authority. Any deviation from the authorities, including questioning, was relegated as the high road to apostasy. As truth people, we eventually took that high road. Isn't that kind of a cool analogy? It's like the when people say you've gone off the deep end. I say, yeah, I prefer the deep over the shallow end. Got tired of that shallow stuff, you know. We then face the difficult process of defining morality, beliefs, and future choices for many areas of our life. Did you bring the Bishop Bills? That's my son. For many of us, this amounted to a complete overhaul of our beliefs, morality, ideals, hopes, fears, everything. Without the selective light of knowing, we now walk in the full light that the lack of certainties and certitudes can only offer. When I speak about ex-Mormons being truth people, I reference an idea by Emerson. Probably some of you have seen this quote. It's a great one. God offers to every mind its choice between truth and repose, safety, comfort. Take what you please. You can never have both. Between these is a pendulum. Man oscillates. He in whom the love of repose predominates will accept the first creed, the first philosophy, the first political party, most likely his father's. He gets rest, commodity, reputation, but he shuts the door of truth. He in whom the love of truth predominates will keep himself aloof from all moorings and afloat. He will abstain from dogmatism and recognize all the opposite negations between which, as walls, his being is swung. He submits to the inconvenience of suspense and imperfect opinion. It's kind of where we find ourselves as truth people, isn't it? A favorite author of mine, Sam Keen, stated it similarly. Sometimes I think there are only two pole stars a person may choose to follow, two radical alternatives, north or south. Either we go toward decision, risk, action, individuation, guilt, self-definition, forgiveness, the joy of being a person, or toward indecision, security, conformity, shame, innocence, boredom, superiority. Either the engaged life or the spectator's life. A cartoon pictures it this way. I don't know if you can see it well enough, but it starts out over there on the left, doubt, shadow of a doubt. Sounds like a growing fast and testimony meeting, doesn't it? Secure understanding, certain knowledge, absolute conviction, I know. And then the great abyss where all certainties and certitudes are abandoned, and notice wisdom lies on the other side. And so as truth people, we consign ourselves to the inconvenience of suspense, that is not knowing. We don't know. We now understand the concept Eric Fromm spoke of when he stated, the quest for certainty blocks the search for meaning. Uncertainty is the very condition to impel man to unfold his powers. I would like to bear my testimony. I don't know if there's a God. I'm not really sure about the purpose of life. I don't know if life goes on in any form beyond death. I don't know if life is simply a physical world of random chance or if some other loving force is in the universe, perhaps life or love. I bear testimony that probably isn't possible to know those things. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Oh, I'm not done. I know you wish I was. Let's get to the slideshow. Sam Keen stated, we're caught in a paradox called the human condition. Our spiritual instinct drives us to connect with the whole of being, but the structure of our minds, limited by the conditions of our mortality, frustrates our desire. In truth, we cannot know enough to be theists or atheists. We have no alternative except to decide whether to trust or mistrust this encompassing mystery. Christian mystic Matthew Fox defines the ideology of mysticism as mysticism, the primal mystery that is the universe itself. It calls for a spiritual awakening to the mystery of the universe and our existence in it. Reentering that mystery is a fundamentally holy act, a sacred discipline. Vernon Howard, in his book, The Mystic Path to Cosmic Power, states a kind of a workable definition of mysticism. An advanced state of inner enlightenment, union with reality, a state of genuinely satisfying success, insight into an entirely new world of living, an intuitive grasp of truth above and beyond intellectual reasoning, and a personal experience in which we are happy and healthy human beings. I suggest as post-Mormons and as truth people, we choose to live the engaged mystic life. As pilgrim souls, we traverse our worlds now in a state of wonder. Accepting the realities of not knowing affords us the ability to open fully to the mystery of each day, each person, each piece of creation. There is angst and fear when we live in the future. Boy, did I learn that one for a year and a half anticipating my ex-wife's death. There is freedom in knowing that all we can do is practice living more authentically and aware in each moment. Our new spiritual journey can return us to the joy we experienced as children. Our priorities shift back to the attempt to find wonder and joy in each day and experience we have. Loud laughter and lots of play are prescribed as medicine for pilgrim souls, especially as we seek to thrive while living in a manic culture that is constantly doing, leaving little time or energy for being. We develop a reverence for all life and creation. We no longer define reverence as sitting in a meeting with arms folded, but as an expression of our feeling awareness of the wonder of each piece of this magical creation, including all life. We now seek to live life both passionately and more compassionately, allowing creativity and giving to replace the ideals of skimming and getting more. I've found the practice of mindfulness to be useful. In its most simple definition, mindfulness is simply paying attention, being aware. Concerning mindfulness, educational researcher Ellen Langer stated, "When we are certain, we don't feel the need to pay attention. Given that the world around us is always in flux, our certainty is an illusion." And Daniel Siegel, in his excellent book, The Mindful Brain, said, "Mindfulness in its most general sense is about waking up from a life on automatic and being sensitive to novelty in our everyday experiences." I think that has to resonate with ex-Mormons. As Mormons, we became so routine in our religious and spiritual expressions that nearly all meaning was lost. Rote and ritual, empowered by social conformity needs, diverted our attention from living mindfully to living mindlessly. Again, Daniel Siegel warns, "As automatic thinking and behaving dominates our subjective sense of the world, life becomes repetitive and dull. Instead of experience having an emergent feeling of fresh discovery as a child sensing the wonder for the first time, we come to feel dead inside, dead before we die. Living on automatic also places us at risk of mindlessly reacting to situations without reflecting on various options of response. The result can often be knee-jerk reactions that in turn initiate similar mindless reflexes in others. A cascade of reinforcing mindlessness can create a world of thoughtless interactions, cruelty, and destruction." Is George Bush in your mind right now, or is it just me? Mindfulness is an advanced state of attunement to self and others, and an advanced state of awareness in general. It is something to practice on a daily basis. For those of you that may be like me, who've attempted meditation and just can't seem to stay with it long enough to get your brain to quiet down, just can't do it, I've found that mindfulness works for me, and it's a little bit different. Rather than trying to quiet the mind, your focus or your intention is to focus the mind on present sensations, feelings, what's going on around you. And it takes the same kind of practice as meditation, because we will naturally kind of divert and go back to our mindless, automatic way of being. One benefit of developing a mindful approach to living is the acceptance of one situation can alleviate the internal battle that may emerge when expectations of how life should be do not match how life is. We inherited subtle messages of shame from our Mormon indoctrination that sin is usually the reason we aren't happy. We now understand that our life journey must include pain. Pain and discomfort is an inevitable reality and consequence of both the human condition as well as our behaviors. Pain experienced from choice can guide us to more healthy choices. We now understand we can only attune to those teachers through our experiences in the present. As we practice letting go of the expectations we develop by living in the future and attune to living more authentically and aware in each moment, we can ease some of the existential angst and reduce the dissonance that eventuates when we do live in the future. Again, I learned that lesson with my ex-wife dying. For 15 months, I was just an idiot, still trying to go to work and be a therapist and, you know, pretend. Anyway, I learned bring it back to now. When my ex-wife died, it was just as horrible as I'd been imagining. I just didn't need to worry about it for 15 months at the level that I did. And so I practiced bringing everything back to now. Mindfulness can be described non-reactivity to inner experience. For example, perceiving feelings and emotions without having to react to them. Of course we all have judgments, but mindfully we attune to whatever judgments we have, and then we can back away and say, okay, is this something that's real, or is this a piece of my old indoctrination? Is coffee bad? Observing, noticing, attending to sensations, perceptions, thoughts, feelings. For example, remaining present with sensations and feelings even when they are unpleasant or painful. Acting with awareness, not on automatic pilot, concentrating, non-distraction. 4, describing, labeling with words, being able to put your world into some kind of meaning that you can actually talk about. And 5, non-judgment of experience is obviously what it's all about. As Mormons, we were taught to walk the right path in life, which was a straight and narrow path. In our new walk in life, we now understand we can and should meander in order for us to grow and flourish. I suggest a mindful approach to wandering this meandering path can both guide us and provide needed boundaries as we experience now with all the wonders of this experience and this existence. Unencumbered by all the fears our religious institution instilled in us, we look to our own inner moral compass now as our most trusted guide. Indeed, the light's inside of me. We now venture beyond the confines of our former safe box. Once afraid to go off the deep end, we tired of splashing in the shallow waters of certainty. Trepidly at first, we step into what we had been taught was the dark and forbidden, and dare experience a greater portion of the human condition. The first time I went to Seattle, there was espresso bars on every frickin' corner. And we didn't know what espresso was. I think we kind of knew it had something to do with coffee. And I was a bishop at this time, by the way, which is when I had my first beer, too. Oh. I got a slide of that coming up. But we ordered an espresso at the Space Needle, and we took a sip. The nastiest stuff. We didn't realize, coffee, cream, and sugar can kind of. We didn't know what we were doing, Yeah, it took me a long time to try coffee again after that. Trepidly, we step into what we had been taught was the dark and forbidden, and dare experience a greater portion of the human condition. Trusting the light within, the necessary journey into the shadow self commences. The journey to wholeness requires the willingness to honestly confront all parts of yourself, all desires, fears, and behaviors. Seeking an integrated and authentic self, we now understand, requires this journey into the real self we were taught to fear. Shadow parts of ourselves can now be revealed and integrated into the self in a healthy way, or perhaps discarded. All previous fears and shame must be honestly confronted from a place of non-judgment. Our deeper quest into the human condition now allows us greater awareness and vision, and consequently less narrow judgment and narrow-mindedness. Black and white realities have merged into a gray awareness of most things. Daniel Siegel kind of summarizes with the acronym COAL what mindfulness can be. We approach our world with curiosity, openness, acceptance, and love. We curiously explore our new world, attempting to be open and accept differences with non-judgment and love. We attune to our fears in this process, note judgments, but attempt to back away from judgments that may be a conditioned response from our previous indoctrination. The fear that there are no boundaries, no morality, in this new meandering path is confronted and discarded as a part of our leftover indoctrination. Of course there are healthy boundaries, but we now choose our boundaries based on an openness to experience, not a fear of it. Comparing my life to a lagoon ride, my previous life as a Mormon was like the merry-go-round. Steady, smooth, safe, and sound, I traveled round and round, rarely encountering much difference in feeling or place. Difference was often feared and relegated as inferior. I eventually realized I was not really going anywhere, although the ride gave that illusion, and it was then that I stepped off the merry-go-round. Today, my life journey feels a bit more like the mousetrap. Ups and downs accentuate the new journey. Sometimes it's exhilarating and just plain old fun. Sometimes it's jerky and uncertain, and I'm pretty certain I'm going off the frickin' edge. When I encounter the myth that ex-Mormons can leave the church but they can't leave it alone, I smile, as you do. Hidden in this idea lies the arrogant, elitist, and narcissistic notion that our way of life is the only right way, and we know you want to come back, right? And so I smile and remember my former narrow thought and try to pull away from this new judgment. I thought similarly, but ultimately I'm aware that after riding the mousetrap, a return to the merry-go-round is neither preferable or even doable. We now seek to live and experience life beyond the numbing confines of conformity. But as we seek to live both passionately and compassionately, we encounter our manic culture that has become increasingly technological and decreasingly intimate and humane. Ideals of needing more than others to be okay masquerade as ambition and success. Skimming each other has become so acceptable we no longer seemingly notice. An increasingly narcissistic and violent culture is the offspring of this discompassionate and disconnected trend. We note institutional religion's contribution in both the formation and sustenance of these separating and exclusive ideals. Indeed, as Daniel Siegel said, a cascade of reinforcing mindlessness can create a world of thoughtless interactions, cruelty, and destruction. Alan Watts noted, irrevocable commitment to any religion is not only intellectual suicide, it is positive unfaith because it closes the mind to any new vision of the world. Faith is, above all, openness, an act of trust in the unknown. We find ourselves trying to thrive in a culture that has much mindlessness and cruelty. Some of the cruelty is seen openly, but much of it lies camouflaged in competitive, egocentric norms. As such, we are again reminded that angst is an inevitable companion in our human condition. We continue to discard messages unconsciously accepted that pain and discomfort are conditions of sin and unworthiness. More aware now, less able to hide in the shadows of ignorance or denial, we are forced to embrace reality more fully. We are all worthy to make our choices and learn from each. There's no unworthiness. There is no unworthiness in a less than healthy choice, unless perhaps we refuse to learn its lessons. Choosing paths that impedes our progress is how we grow. There is no need to shame people through the very means by which we grow. Of course, we encounter turbulence in the new flight. Resistance is futile. We attempt to embrace the full spectrum of the human experience, which includes all the pain and angst that reality is. We painfully concede at each new lesson that our greatest growth usually comes from the darkest and most alone nights. And we learn that the mystic path is often a very lonely and painful walk. And we trust that from the dark nights we can emerge into the greater light of love, justice, and compassion. This allows us to trust the universe on some level. I suggest that truth and compassion are the ideals we continue to seek, especially in our encounters with those still believing in religion. Anger at those who deceived and controlled us is inevitable. Because of our wounds and perhaps shame that we believed in the myths too long, we're tempted to project that anger at those who remain in that safe life space still. We sometimes feel this anger acutely when we encounter the judgmentalism of those still believing. We understand and accept our anger, but ultimately recognize the reality that we too believed and made narrow judgments while in that state. Aware of the importance of all the stages of development now, we can accept and perhaps feel gratitude for this part of our journey that led us to our present awareness. As we deal with believers, and I'm speaking mostly of Mormons here, we remind ourselves what Samuel Johnson stated, prejudice not being founded on reason cannot be removed by argument. Y'all had those times when you first came out, didn't you, where you're going to, maybe some of you are in that now, where you're going to convince people. With my ex-wife, I knew I could lay it all out in such a way that it would make perfect sense. And every time I would try that, I would just, actually, a few times I acted out this, I'd go bang my head on the wall. It's just like, why do I keep doing this? It doesn't work. Seeking to convince others, particularly those who now feel threatened by our disbelief, that our life path is right or preferable, feels similar to what we are seeking to grow beyond. Rather, we seek to transcend our own ego and ethnocentricities in quest of a deeper connection to all. From this place, we have better awareness of the various stages of development and try not to shame those in levels we've outgrown. The mystic Albert Einstein stated, this is kind of a common quote in ex-Mormon world, isn't it? A human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. From these perspectives, and in summary, I would say our goals as post-Mormons: practice living authentically and mindfully in each moment and day. And I guarantee you that you'll suck at it. You have to keep doing it and reminding yourself. It's so easy to go back on automatic pilot. Seek to simply be aware of reality on a daily basis. Be gentle with yourself, for hell's sakes. Remember compassion for yourself and others, and find your way to free yourselves from the shame and fear ghosts of the past. And may you never lose the wonder. Now, I have a disclaimer I'd like to give before we do this. That was the stuffy part of what I did, anyway. I'm going to actually show you an example of this journey. It starts out with me as the good little Mormon boy, and I think you'll see it's kind of a before and after thing. But I've been to Burning Man 7 years in a row. And for those of you that don't know, Burning Man is a festival of radical free expression out in the Nevada desert. To me, it always felt like the perfect pilgrimage for Mormons, ex-Mormons, because we grew up in this box, and at Burning Man, there's just no box. Whatever. But an important lesson is that when you remove the controls, what tends to eventuate is community and compassion and sharing, not the lack of control. There's some wonderful lessons out there. But what I want you to see from these slides, and I have other things mixed in there, events from some of our post-Mormon meetings, and but this is rated G for garments. And I need to make something kind of clear about this. I ate, slept, and drank Mormonism for many, many years. I taught it full time. 6 days a week, I was studying it and living it and teaching it. I was a bishop in the mid-90s. And when I was a bishop, I only halfway believed it. So that was an interesting experience. So in my journey out, what you're going to see in Burning Man pictures is in the beginning, you know, this incredible passion that me and Steve and gratefully Jeff Ricks, all of us were similarly screwed up. and we had a great need to do a lot of stupid things. And I like, not stupid, but I look back on it now and I think, where did we get all that energy and passion to do all that stuff? But in the 7 years that you'll see here, and it's not really clear, you won't notice the 7 years, but the first few years, the first year we built a temple altar. As a matter of fact, if I tell you the story, a friend of mine who's a psychologist down in Orem called me up and he said, hey, have you ever heard of Burning Man? This was in 2000. I'd never heard of it. He explained it to me, and within 20 minutes, I owned a ticket. There's something in my soul that just said, I got to go to the desert. And didn't know what we were doing, but we built a temple altar, you know, the two little sides that you kneel on, and my brother and I built it, and we didn't even know what the hell we were going to do with it. We took it out to Burning Man, we sat it there, and it was like, oh, what do we do with this now? So the next year we realized we needed to build the temple to put the altar in, so you'll see pictures of that. The third year is when we got Steve Clark and Jeff Ricks going, and these guys are just crazy. They get shit done. Now, I'm lazy, and I'm disorganized, but you put these guys on something, and you're going to get some stuff done. So we did Planet Kolob that year. The next year we did Adam on Diamond, but the year we did Planet Kolob, I was almost at the end. I just couldn't take much more Mormon stuff. And the next year, Adam on Diamond, we had a name for our camp, but other than that, there wasn't much Mormon-y stuff to it. After that, we got completely away from the Mormon thing. We had the Burning Drummers camp. 2005, we did Camp Narcissism. And then in 2006, Melly and I just went out and just had a kick-ass time together. So that's... I wanted you to kind of see or know that that's what you'll be seeing here. So if I can get this working,
is your friend over there?
We're all okay, aren't we, Jared?
You are talking about you.
Right.
Where's Matt?
I think we're probably set. Hit the lights out.
Standing on these mountains and plains,
I was a bishop. Art of homemaking, if you can't read that. Alcohol was involved. I was blessing myself there.
Fall into the stars below.
Those aren't garments on my daughter.
Sun's not going down at all, but the earth is turning somersaults. And through a sunlit sea of trails, we are on that great big wave. We're riding on that great big wave.
That's scary. Says Jesus of Narcissus. I'm the narcissistic Jesus. Save your own ass. I didn't finish doing my disclaimer on the garments. I got sidetracked there. So I'm going to do it now. We would never wear the garments in a place where believing members were. That would never be something we'd want to do because we wouldn't want to offend them. So we chose places we could get out away from people and do that. So people have... you know, confronted me on that before, and I think when they realize we would never do it in front of people that it would offend, hopefully that helps a bit. But that was just one way. That was actually my way and Mel's way of kind of coming out. We don't believe that there's any one certain way. We get the Tom. You want to hit those lights, Ken? Or One of the pictures, at Burning Man, they burn the man on Saturday night, but Sunday night they have a solemn burn of the temple. And I don't know if you remember, there's a picture. We made a memorial to my ex-wife, and the Sunday burn of the temple is kind of a very kind of not solemn. Rambunctious. It's solemn, and so it was really kind of cool. Mel and I took the just a poster out. Each one of my kids had written something to their mom, and it was cool, very healing for us. So anyway, that's our deal. Now we want to get you all involved. So let me just throw out a couple of ideas, and then we'll see what we can get going with everybody involved. It seems to me like there's two major parts in this process. There's the from the beginning of disbelief to when you actually stop believing. And that was 7 years in my life, and I think most people aren't that slow. Like Janet, 2 months. Boom, she's out. I see now. I'm done with that crap. Because I was teaching seminary and living it so fully, it took me quite a while. But then I also started realizing I have 7 year phases, like the Hebrew whole. The second phase is kind of like when you stop believing until you come to, a place of resolve of where am I at with my life. And I want to tell you, you can leave the church and you can leave it alone. Especially if I could leave Utah, I think I would really leave it alone. But so there's these two periods, and I think we're mostly talking about that second period of once you really know it's not true. And I'll tell you, I've told this story years ago at this conference. I was sitting in my seminary office in 1997, and I was rereading B.H. Roberts' book, Studies in the Book of Mormon. I'd read it 4 years earlier, but I had an epiphany, a revelation, whatever you want to call it, in that moment that, oh, this is just a bunch of shit. And it hit me so powerfully. I have never to this day doubted that. It was just a real clear idea. And I think it's because it took me 7 years to come out. That brick by brick, that when the last brick was gone, there was nothing left. So then there's this second period, when you know it's not true. And most of us talk about this feeling of peace that we have there for a minute. It's just like, whew, I'm not holding up all that crap anymore. But then there's the complexity of, oh, hell, what am I going to do with my life now? And that's that second period from that place to when you hit a point of resolve. I couldn't have imagined how much garbage my life would have gone through in that seven-year period of time. But as we said, it's the greatest growth comes from that. So we're kind of interested in just engaging y'all in any discussion, thoughts, questions, how you've done it, what things that have worked for you as far as getting past the ghosts, the fear and shame ghosts of the past. We were just out of control, you know, doing that kind of stuff. But we had to take the power out of it. And same thing like with the garments. You know, again, I'd never do that in front of people that it would offend. But if I can go out to Burning Man and do it out at Burning Man, nobody had a slightest clue what we were doing. It was out there. It's just like normal to wear funky stuff like that. But it felt so damn good to put those tie-dye G's on and just walk around. The temple outfit itself, the robes and all that, they don't accept the dye very well, so I can't recommend that. But you get the cotton one-piecers and you'll look like, you know, Dr. Seuss character. It's great. But anyway, we'd like to engage everyone. There's a mic here, and just... we probably ought to go to the mic, yeah. So please feel free to step up. Questions, thoughts, comments, how you're doing it.
I've been curious this whole weekend of how many people here have suffered depression or been treated for depression while they were members of the church. Could you raise your hands if you're... Okay, I was just curious because I went through severe depression before I came out.
Well, we're really getting right into the group therapy, aren't we?
For me, when I first decided I didn't want to have it anymore, I didn't have any religion at all. Pretty much went to church in NASCAR for a couple of years and enjoyed that. But now I'm Unitarian and love it with my dad. I'm finally now at a place I've never really resigned yet. And this weekend is really, I'm ready to make that move and to submit my letter. And to really just have that resolve, because I can't go on without it. Thanks.
You know, I remember a panel up here. Go ahead,
I'm sorry, I was just going to suggest that let's each give, if we come up, give you guys a little bit of time to respond before the next person comes up, okay?
I remember a panel I did with Steve and Marianne Benson and a couple other folks up here back 4 or 5 years ago, and I was the only one then who had not had my name removed. I never felt really any compunction to do that. I didn't give the church enough power to even care. But I went through some circumstances where my my ex-wife was excommunicated, and the way they treated her was just, so me and my two older boys had our names removed more as a way to just say, you.
Yeah. I'd like to share with all of you the beginning of the end for me. Within about a year after going to the first experience with the temple was just god-awful. And I only continued to go back due to feeling obligated, okay? That was just kind of the thing to do. We all got together once a month and went on a temple journey. But within about a year after I was going, I went through a particular session where as soon as I got in the room, the first room, and sat down, I started to become very ill. I just felt very nauseated. I felt dizzy. I was sweating. And just kept fighting it, thinking that I was going to make it through the session. And it finally got to the point where I actually had to get up and excuse myself. I went out into the hallway where I ran into the temple worker there. And she could see that I was about ready to pass out. And directed me over to where I could lie down, and I just continued to feeling worse and worse. She said, well, I don't think you're going to be able to continue through the session. Why don't you give me the name of the person that you were going through for, and we'll assign it to somebody else. I did so, and when she looked at the name, this horrified look came over her face, and she said to me, you are the third person that we've tried to give this name to today, and they've all gotten very sick. That was the beginning. I thought, something's really wrong here if this person doesn't want to go through the temple. Unfortunately, it took me about 20 years to finally put in my resignation after that, but I didn't ever go back to the temple again after that.
I don't know if you want to respond.
I'm curious about how many of you would say you had I don't quite know how to define traumatic, but because my first experience at the temple wasn't traumatic, it was just weird. But how many of you would say you had more of a traumatic experience on your first experience? And then how many would you say it was just weird, way more weird than you thought? How many it was a... Right, or maybe a peaceful, positive, good experience was. How many here were pre-90 when they got rid of the penalties? And how many after that? You know, they really sanitized it up, and so. Please.
This yesterday session with the fundamentalist gentleman that spoke to us, I realized that my dad would have been a great fundamentalist, and many of the tactics that he used with the priest in my home and with my brothers were very, very similar in nature. He would have been a superb polygamist, you know. I guess my experience in the church, I was true blue as true blue could be. Elders' Quorum present for probably 7 years total, 9 years in the presidency, you know, predictions of me being the next bishop, so on and so forth. I'm too young, but it's going to happen. And, you know, secretly, I desired to be a bishop because I'd been told by many leaders that I would be a bishop. And you know, the thing that I realized when I was getting into my mid-30s is that I was dying inside. And in reflection back now, I remember just going through the cycle of self-abuse over me not living up to the standards, hating myself. I remember my lowest of lows because I did the M thing.
Whacking off.
However you want to make it look.
You know, it's easier.
I remember, especially in leadership, how could I do such a thing? And so there was times that I was so devastated by my own simple, natural behavior, I would look in the mirror and, you suck, you know? And the guilt and all of that. And when I started to finally come out and realize that my whole life had been just taken away from me. I'm in my 30s. Everyone thought I was confident. I was insecure. I hated myself. I lived a facade. And then putting down that fear was huge for me. And when I realized that my life had been controlled by fear of what I was doing or what I wasn't doing, and all my decisions were based upon that fear, the walls come crumbling down. And then that same elated moment of freedom, and then what the hell am I going to do? And I'll never forget my wife, because I realized that my whole life at that time had been built around my family and church. And when I told my wife at the time, her face was complete devastation. And the lack of understanding, me laying it out, trying to make that connection, and dying inside and fighting for self-preservation, I had to stand. And that wedge went so wide that it eventually was destroyed. But I must say, it's been the most challenging thing in my life. But the things that I have learned beyond it and who I've become, I look in the mirror now and I think, I like you. You know? And I must say that I'm now married, remarried, and I'm married to a childhood friend. Paula, please stand up. I'm going to show you off. At the age of 12, I used to save the bus seat, school bus seat for her, and had a big crush on her, but she was an older woman, so I couldn't tell her. And with this wholeness that is now coming to me, there's still the lingering pain of not having my children in my home. But this wholeness which has come upon me and who I've become has been because of the things that I've been able to let go, and now the companionship that I have and the openness has just completely enriched my life, and I don't regret it. So.
I'm not sure Emerson was right when he said, you know, there's only two kind of people, the truth and the repose people, but it makes a lot of sense to me that us folks here really are the truth people. And I don't know that our experience reflects all of, you know, there's a lot of people that I think come into Mormonism and are mostly blessed by it, and they say they stay safe and sound, and I think we got to recognize that too. But I wanted to add, you know, my four kids, two have came out with me, and then my two younger ones were with their mom when we split up, and when she died, her funeral was mostly about how can we guilt these kids into staying in the church because of their apostate piece of shit dad, you know, of course. And my youngest son, who is the one I was most worried about, and he's sitting right here right now, so I'm feeling pretty good. He brought some bishop bills. Brad, show them. At Burning Man 1 year, we passed out these things that and they have a little statement on the back about, you know, we can pass these out. Actually, we had them from Burning Man 03. Wow. Bishop Bill, come unto me, all you that labor, and I will give you rest. I'm your handy go wherever confessional bishop, therapist, or just your pal. You can confess all your naughty sins to me, ventilate, catharsis, or just unload on me. I'll always be there for you. You can trust me. I'll never tell anyone. I'd never leave you, my precious, precious child. Is that the cheesiest? That's me, man. Please.
I just wanted to relate a different experience that with the temple that I think that most other people had. I'm a very traditional person, and I like history and those kind of things. And when I went through the temple the first time, didn't really feel very much. But I remember, like, a couple of weeks later, going there when I was in the LTM, and I turned around and looked behind me, and I noticed there's a lady from my old home ward in Wyoming, and her husband was there, who had been a Jack Mormon he was the judge of the town. He'd been a Jack Mormon his entire life. Somehow he'd got reactivated, and he'd gone to church, and I looked back, and I saw him, and I suddenly felt this family connection about somebody who, you know, that not only had these people that I'd known all in my ward and all in my small town, but there was generation about generation and generation of people who'd gone through the church and had done the same kind of slitting the throat things, and instead of turning around and feeling like this was weird, I felt like there was a connection between me and all the way through time, all the way back to Adam. Now, it had the opposite effect when I turned around, and I felt really the spirit really strong at that point in time. It had the opposite effect to find out years later that they had removed things from the temple ceremony, and it really wasn't the same one that Joseph Smith did. It was not the same one that Peter, James, and John did. It didn't really go all the way back to Adam. Mm-hmm. So even though at one point in time I felt this really strong connection, it actually had a reverse effect, kind of not finding out that I'd been lied to, that it really wasn't even the same that Joseph Smith did. And so sometimes when people go through the temple, they have really negative experience. I had a really positive one that years later had even a double negative effect.
Wow, cool. Wow. Thanks for sharing that. You know, I tell people that you can tell how far a person is out of the church by where their garments are at. You know how the progression goes. You start wearing one half or the other, or you only wear it when you're going to be around people so they'll see the line. Then pretty soon they start going in the drawer in the back, and Sue's got a great story on this that she needs to tell. And then, you know, eventually they're in the closet, and you know, probably for most of us at some point we just need to burn them up or do something, you know, as a way to let it go.
I just had one question. The next time you guys go to Burning Man, will you please take me with you?
Yes.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I also wanted to say, you know, that first slide I had up there, Ron Williams and me were companions. Ron, stand up. He doesn't like that. We were out field teaching or tracting, and this tells you what 19-year-olds you know, when they're out teaching the world's truths. But we're walking down the road, and we said, you know, this would make a great picture. And so we got our tripod and set it up in the middle of the road. And, you know, Ron would have to take it and then run, and then we'd act like we're just walking along. Then, and I'd forgotten this part, but Ron reminded, we actually sent that slide to the, or that picture to the Ensign, hoping to make front cover. So the other day I did a little Photoshop, put Ensign on that picture, and it's kind of fun.
Okay, so I have a few comments and a question. I just want to say it's a great, it was just such a great slideshow and such a great presentation. I just couldn't, I couldn't stop crying through the whole thing. It was so amazing. I almost came to that 2002 yeah. Burning Man. I was on the list and yeah. I couldn't go at the last minute. And now it's just like, boy, I really missed out. But I think for me too. I think the temple experience was one of the defining moments in like my church experience that I think helped you know, take me out. It took me another 70 years after that. Mm-hmm. But I was promised it would be the most spiritual day of my life. It was far from that. I was traumatized. I was extremely upset, and then yet I couldn't talk about it. I saw, then, like the next month, I went to see the play Les Miserables, and then a month after that, I went to see the Rolling Stones in concert. Had far more spiritual experiences at both of those than I did at the temple, and that was a big sign for me. I think your things that you guys did at Burning Man, you know, some people would probably be offended by that, but I think we've all done, you know, similar things to try and just help us get past the silliness of it all. Back when we first started these conferences in 97, we used to pass out sacrament trays with, you know, shots of alcohol in them, and we used to...
We did all that at Burning Man. I just didn't have good enough pictures.
Yeah, so I was just going to say it's a great job. Do you think that kind of... those kinds of making fun is healthy? I'm assuming that, personally, I do. I'm just assuming that you're a proponent of that as well.
I think, as our friend Barb always brought up to me, is to take the power out of the organization that had, you know, the garments or anything that, you know, you're still holding on to take the power away that controlled you in any way you can do that is healthy, I think.
Especially if you're not hurting those. Right. I think we have to be careful about that. We're not here to hurt those that still believe, you know. Right. Although at times we want to when we get some of their judgment stuff.
And I'm glad you made that clarification. That really helped. I know that was a discussion my husband and I had last night, you know, where... trying to open up that understanding that sometimes that's very powerful for someone in their healing and to find a safe place where someone can do that if that's what's necessary for them. And mine kind of ties in. I'm just brand new out the end of July. Haven't sent a letter yet. And I'm hoping my husband will join me. And he's open and supportive, you know, but not completely on board yet. But I know even in discussing to him, once we finally got where we could, you know, talk about it a little bit, I mentioned to him on the Black Sheep roster, wow, I saw people that listed their new names, you know. And it's sort of interesting because I had forgotten my new name. I hadn't known it for years and had never quite gotten around to...
Have you remembered it?
Well, no, but I said, you know what?
You're lost.
You know, speaking the unspoken, tell me what it is. We don't have to wait, you know. Just tell me what it is right here. You know, what does it matter? You know, just tell me. And he told me. And I was like, okay, that was nice. And I said, do you think you'll ever be at a spot you can tell me yours? And, you know, and saying, you know, no pressure on you. But for me, speaking the unspoken has such power. And
exactly.
And so he gave me a hint, and I guessed it, and I figured for where he is now, that is awesome. Yeah. You know, so. Anyway.
And you know, we honor each space in the journey. You know, there's that time where I couldn't have said that. And so, yeah, it's all really all about taking the power out of the mythology and the silliness. I mean, when you really get how silly these... Matter of fact, just a really brief story. I was a... Yeah, good, Sue. I want to hear that. I was conducting a temple... I was conducting a temple recommend interview, and I got to the question about, do you wear the authorized garment both day and night? And just a thunderbolt hit me of how incredibly fucking intrusive... that question is. What business does this church and me asking this question have to inquire about what kind of underwear you're wearing at night? That's when I got into there was some real anger at the garments, at how much intimacy those garments had robbed me and my wife. And I've tried to get Mel to put on some, I can't even get her to, you know, the tie-dyed ones, nothing. She just... That's fine. The last time I went to the temple, it was at my nephew and niece's wedding. I had actually married them as a bishop first, but then a year later they went and did it right. And we were sitting in the sealing room, and the sealing dude said, the sealer said something about, you know, return. I'm sure you guys don't remember this, but but he said, you know, come back to the temple often, da 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 da, because it's here that we learn the mysteries of godliness. What year was that? 96. I was still a bishop then. I'm sitting next to my ex-wife Kathy and who was my wife at the time, and I just said, bullshit. And it just hit me with this incredulous, the mysteries of godliness, which knuckle you're going to put your hand on? Holy hell, if that's the mysteries of godliness, it rumbled out of me, and of course Kathy jabbed me, shut up, you can't ever keep your mouth shut. That was my last time at the temple.
Couple things real quick. When are you going to replace, like, what's her name, King, or my cousin Dee Dee Wimmer? We need somebody on the news that's good. And I'd like you to go back on KSL and just do it right this time.
Who are you talking to?
You.
Oh. Were you on the news? Or are you smoking?
Weren't you a reporter?
Something?
No.
You weren't? Okay. Well, you'd be good. I just want to, my input is this. After 6 years away, leaving with my wife and having that little girl that, sorry she's interrupting, she was the one that was going to bring us back because it was a miracle after 17 years. And, you know, Mormons are bigots. I'm just sorry. They're just bigots. I mean, you can't say anything bad about Mitt Romney because then that, you know, makes you a bigot. But they can say anything they want to you about anything. So, number one, when you look up bigotry, that fits the bill. And yet we're supposed to accept everything they say to us on the outside and take it with no conditions. And we have to sit there and listen. And finally, me and my wife, we're done. And so now when people ask us, we're calm and we say, you know, do you really want to know? And, you know, God bless the elders. They keep coming to the house with no-knock warrants and just, you know, I'm watching football and they come and I'll say, you can come in if you want. And we had a beautiful experience the other day because, you know, it's been a year after, right before conference, they come by. And these great elders, and I always let them in because I was an elder. And this beautiful kid asked me, what will it take, Brother White, to get you back? And I said, you know, I want to see Gordon Hinckley raise someone from the dead. I'll be back. I've got an open mind. And they came back a week later, and my beautiful wife asked him, so did he raise Faust? And we haven't seen him since. But I just wanted to share that with you because that was an impacting moment for us to realize, you know what? There is no more crap. I don't care which family member asks. It doesn't matter anymore. You know, they're not going to be bigots to me without me responding. And that's where we're at in life. And that's what's beautiful about this conference. And God bless you all.
I'm about halfway through writing a paper on cultural narcissism and Mormonism. And when you really understand what narcissism is, Mormonism creates and breeds this incredible cultural expression of narcissism. And so when you're coming out of it like that, it used to irritate me that Brad, I couldn't say anything negative to him or any of my old seminary students or anything, so I didn't want to harm their faith. But yet they can be told all kinds of crap about how screwed up I was all the way along. And it was that same kind of narcissistic, we're right, so we can say it, but don't be telling my kids. I had a woman come and scream at me that I taught her kid in seminary in my house. I'd never even met her. She walked in my house. You either lied to my daughter who you had in seminary, you're lying. And her son was there, one of my friend, my son's friends. And I'd never said a word to this kid about the church. But she left, and I just thought, my hell, these people have no clue how narcissistic they are. And it spread in them. Here's Mr. Sierra, our beer man.
Right. I want to build on his theme. Last year, my wife and I had been out about 6 months, and him and his good wife, our heads were spinning, what the hell are we doing here? And come on over, have a beer. Okay. So they were very nice to us. I want to tell you something about, some of you know a little bit about my background. I'm not going to go into that because some of it's pretty personal and some of it's stuff I shouldn't really talk about. But one thing I learned when I was in Afghanistan is that there's a huge propaganda machine, and the Mormon Church is a massive propaganda machine. My buddy at West Point, we were in Iraq together. He's a pharmacist. He's just working on his PharmD at Walter Reed. We were at West Point together. When I left the church, my wife and I were about a year. We called him and said, actually, we were out about 9 months, and told him that we'd left the church. He was just all crying and stuff. This guy is super, super smart. He's one of these guys that's like, he's got a twin brother who's a code writer for the military. Okay, so these guys are like super brilliant guys. He came out of the church in about 2 days. Once he started reading, he called me back and he said, holy shit, you're right. I read real slow, The Cat in the Hat. This guy reads, he reads as a page, he can look down a page, he can read it just like that and remember what's on there. And he went to CGSC, which is Command General Staff College at Fort Belvoir. And he was calling me all the time because his wife is now just starting to come out of the church. And I wrote about this on Postmo. And she's starting to come out now too. And he was telling me about, he just couldn't believe the propaganda when they're going through war college and learning about propaganda, the bullshit in the Mormon church and propaganda for creating wars and manipulating politics and all this other kind of stuff. Great education, war college, Command General Staff. But what I want to say is the fear of the threat is worse than the threat itself. That's the one thing I learned in Afghanistan, working with ops guys, and you're going out there doing stuff, working with Taliban and working with these warlords and stuff, trying to set up a new community, which has now fallen in on us because we always did was finance them. And now they're turning against us just like they did the Russians. But anyway, that's a whole different story. But the bottom line is do not allow people to manipulate you. Know what the truth is and go with it, baby. I am a trigger puller. And what I mean by that is... What I mean by that is when you know something's right, you just do it in the hell with everybody else. Because if you don't, then you're going to be living the old Mormon way. Just put it to the side. Do what's right because it's the right thing to do. My family and I have a motto now. It's the thing that we have determined how to live our lives. And it's something I picked up from this old colonel in the Army. He says, never be involved in anything that's illegal, immoral, or unethical. And do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And if you do that, you can sleep at night.
And how cool, this good brother, he's handing out the Sierra Nevada Pale Ales. And I told him how Burning Man-esque of you, because at Burning Man, that's what it's all about. Just how can I bless you and how let me do something here for you. So that was cool.
I'd be curious in your input and how you respond to the narcissism that you referred to. I face that on a regular basis. 3 years ago, I was in a bishopric. Before that, a scoutmaster for several years and stake young men's president, and have 8 children who are still TBM. And
all of them?
All right. Of them. One son on a mission in the Ukraine that I'm supporting, one who just got home from Brazil a year ago, and one who's planning to leave in... another year. And I'm the apostate. They're still I agreed in the divorce proceedings that they would continue to attend in the ward, where they're told that even the very elect will be deceived and your dad's been deceived, and all these kids that I've worked with and have these great relationships with, that they don't want me to talk to them. How do you deal with that? I mean, on one hand, I just want to be straightforward and go out and tell them. I think, that's going to be counterproductive. I said the first night, I had a great deal of hope from this conference and hearing Sandy talk about, her family and over the years how they've come together. But I'm just torn how to respond to these TBM family members. My mother last Thanksgiving called me to repentance and told me I was destroying her grandkids. And I just tell them, you know, I can't profess something that I don't believe. And that's one way I can respond. But I, you know, at times I want to strangle them. At times I just want to set an example. And I don't know where to go. And, you know, my wife's in the same position. She has 6 kids from another marriage. We have 14 between us. And of her 6, only 4 of them are still TBM.
Have you learned to drink yet?
Yeah.
Substance is help.
I have. But not when they're around. And so maybe that's what I need to do.
Well, first of all, what an incredible... I share whatever junk you're going through and have a lot of empathy for it. It's a journey, and I think depending on where you're at, if you're really in that place of anger, you know, you need to get with people that are safe and be able to work through all that so that then when you go back into, you know, la-la land and have to deal with them, you can try to deal with them compassionately. And when I went through my divorce, I think the guilt that hit me was how much I had tried to change her. She didn't want it. She was safe and sound in the box, and I was just so damn afraid of losing the marriage and breaking up the family that I was frantic. I was passionate about, you got to read this stuff, and you got to, you know, and some of the stuff Bob was talking about yesterday, you know, boom, I connected with. I think you have to do your healing with people that are safe, and that's why this is so important, so awesome that these people keep, you know, doing this stuff. And then as you come out, I think it's kind of given to you, especially as you mindfully just are aware of what's real right now, what are people feeling, what am I feeling. And I wish I could have been a little more graceful, especially in the way I did it with my ex-wife. You know, when she died, that's the caustic, toxic guilt, shame, junk that just pervaded me for a while. But,
can I say something? Yeah. We have a friend who we were talking to the other day, and she's got, Alice, how many kids? 6 or 7 kids? Anyway, she's got 6 or 7 kids, and they're all in the church.
She's
pretty
the
good.
She's the lady who had the slippers on her ears.
Yeah, yeah. And for years, she's really battled... connecting with them, because it's the same thing. They wanted to keep the grandkids away and different things like that. And the last time we talked to her, some of her boys were going through some real life experiences for the first time in their life. One was a divorce and some other things. And I think through life, people start to go through stuff like that. And to have a parent who they can turn to that they know is kind of in reality, they really have connected. Not so much yet on the church issue, but as mom had some struggles and she's really not crazy and she's helping me out. So for them to know that, you know, they have that when they go through those life struggles can help.
I think it's so darn important we stay in that place of compassion with them. We were there. And yeah, the anger is normal, but do that with, because eventually, hopefully we can show them this really is a higher path. It's a further path.
Can I make a comment on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess.
We do have to end quickly.
I just have to make a comment because in those early years in my marriage, I failed really bad with how I handled the transition. Yeah. I was so angry, and you know the force was pressing against me, so it was something to push back and to stand on. And the things that were said were so damaging, and that's the guilt that I still carry, is the way that I handled it. And it all came out in anger and passion, and I destroyed things that did not need to be destroyed. Right. Yeah. And now that I've pulled away from that and that force is not pushing against me, I see myself in a much clearer way of the things that I did wrong. The one thing with my children, I was deemed unworthy, a wacko, whatever words that they want to put to that. And I have not made that so much an issue of conversation with them, but now what I'm starting to see is with my teenagers, because I'm not asking them to act the way I did, is they are now coming to me and saying, Dad, I feel this way. Dad, I'm thinking this. And they have this safe place with me, and they feel a lot more open, and it's just starting to come now. So I'm feeling hopeful, and that's, to me, the biggest thing. So
trust the process.
I was just going to... I was just going to share two quick things. One is when I decided to stop wearing my garments, which was I came down for a wedding down here, and it was hot. And I just saw all these people wearing, like, you know, the culture here, all wearing their garments. And, you know, I had consciously left the church and decided I was never going to go back. And seeing all these people wearing their garments, and I just went, I'm not one of them. I don't identify with them. And it was hot, so I got rid of them. And it's so funny that it happened in Salt Lake, of all places. But the other thing, and you guys kind of touched on this, is that working through this process, yes, there's a lot of anger, and I think the biggest thing is to really act in a form of forgiveness, especially forgiving yourself for believing the way you did, because you really didn't know any different, and forgiving Mormons for the way they act, and really accepting forgiving a tiger for acting like a tiger, and I think if you can keep that mindset of forgiveness and let people act how they want to be, then it's a lot easier transition than anger and rage.
It's the church, not the people. Remember that little couplet? It's the church, not the people. And the people are still wonderful human beings.
Thank you so much, you guys. This has been so good. Very quickly, I could have Bill here every single year, and it wouldn't be too much because he always has a lot to say and that helps a lot of people. Again, reminder, those who live locally can take stuff home in their cars. I'm going to run into the hospitality room, pull some of that unopened wine up, put it on the table. If you want to take it, give us a little donation. But if anything that's already open, just feel free to take it. Look in the ice chest, because a lot of us are flying, and we cannot take it home with us, so it needs to go. Also, one more time, reading glasses that were left in the hospitality room last night. I have them up here if they belong to anybody. I missed thanking Arza Evans earlier for his contributions these last few years of his books. It's just such a wonderful thing that you do, Arza, and we thank you so much. It's such a nice thing for us. And Bob, I don't know if you're still in here. We did announce that your cord was missing, and so far I don't think anybody has seen it. Pardon? No, I haven't tried. He probably has. But anyway, if anybody sees a missing little cord crawling around, it belongs to Bob. I think that's it. And again, the glasses out there, if you want them, they're 2 for $5. Take as many as you want. And we will see you all next year with all more members of your families, hopefully, here. Bye.